Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Why are most pharmacies in Liberia selling stolen medicines donated by aid organizations?
I think corruption in Liberia is a cultural phenomenon. It's very common, it's systemic, and this is contributing to a very significant portion of the Liberian population not having access to basic healthcare services, especially women and children in rural communities.
We look at Kenya's efforts to flush out bandits and end banditry in the restive north.
It's a long-term approach. We can't just get rid of it overnight. It is a gradual process, but we need to have the political will to change it. So biting the bullet, having them brought to book and held to account.
And the clamor for civil and political rights in Zimbabwe.
So what we'd advocate for is generally that culture of promoting these freedoms and these rights be institutionalized, particularly within the police, so that they also appreciate that it is indeed normal sometimes to raise a complaint.
It's Wednesday, the 17th of April. First, we go to Liberia. 90% of pharmacies in Liberia are selling stolen medicine donated by aid organizations. This is according to the U.S. Agency for International Development. The U.S. Aid Mission Director, Jim Wright, at the weekend said such acts of fraud prevented Liberians from receiving donated essential medicines. Following the revelation, six Liberian civil groups have launched a national media campaign aimed at monitoring the distribution of aid medical supplies and raising awareness that donated medicines are free and should not be sold. Liberians have long expressed disappointment with past governments for apparent failure to tackle corruption. To find out the circumstances behind this, I called up a community activist, John Alexander Nyan Jr., Executive Director of Community Health Education and Social Services in Monrovia. First things first, how did medicine donated by aid agencies in Liberia find its way in the market?
I think there is a syndicate of public and private sector actors who are collaborating to corrupt the system and ensure that drugs that are donated by donors like USAID and others are not reaching the intended beneficiaries, but are being directed to private pharmacists owned by international businessmen and Liberians themselves. So it's a syndicate of corrupt officials, both in public and private sectors, that are working to rob the Liberian people of their needed benefit when it comes to access to good health and well-being.
Do we know how many quantities we are looking at this time? Has that been established?
We cannot clearly say the quantity that has been stolen, but there are different fundings from credible institutions, including the USAID, that have indicated that up to 90% of all donated drugs in Liberia end up in private pharmacy across the country. And this is very concerning to us as civil society actors, because we as a health policy research institution, we want to ensure that there is full universal health coverage being established or achieved, and then citizens have access to basic healthcare services, especially drugs like malaria commodities. And we think that if malaria drugs are not available, you are exposing a strong portion of our population to a lot of catastrophe.
Have we been able to identify what loopholes or gaps did exist in the distribution system now leading to this?
I think the major gap within the distribution system is with the transportation and quality assurance. Because normally the drugs will leave Monrovia, which is the capital city of Liberia, and then it's being transported into the different counties. It is between that value chain, that transport line, that the drugs are being directed, and there is where the major issue is.
So who takes responsibility for this? Who failed, actually?
I think it's the government, the supply chain unit at the Ministry of Health should take full responsibility of this, because it is their legal responsibility to ensure that all donated medications are distributed to the last mile health facilities. And if those medications don't reach those health facilities, it means that the Ministry itself must be held responsible. But I think the citizens must be able to stand up through different media, including civil society, to call on government and key stakeholders to ensure that they account for all donated drugs that are being given by donors like USAID.
And what is the government saying? Have you reached out to the government as a coalition? What's their response?
We have held different high-level stakeholders dialogue with the just nominated and confirmed Minister of Health, Dr. Tokoto. We've held meetings with the planning department at the Ministry of Health. We have as well engaged the county health system, and they all are saying that the situation is systemic. It requires a collective effort, because there has just been a transition in government, and maybe the new team that is coming over that is presenting with a high signal of ensuring that this syndicate of corrupt public and private sector actors is cut off or eliminated. And they are saying that they are committed, if made a priority one, to ensure that the diversion of medical commodities no longer happen.
So the USAID attributes, you know, this issue to corruption. I wonder how endemic is corruption in Liberia, and how is that undermining efforts to, you know, strengthen the provision of healthcare to the population?
I think corruption in Liberia is a cultural phenomenon. It's very common, it's systemic, and this is contributing to a very significant portion of the Liberian population not having access to basic healthcare services, especially women and children in rural communities. This is actually undermining the healthcare service delivery of Liberia.
And what will be the implications of this? Could donors pull the plug on Liberia?
We are not calling for donors to pull a plug on Liberia. We are calling to reinforce citizen engagement with the government and the distribution process, so that citizens themselves can ensure that whatever that leaves from the warehouses are being monitored through the civil society network. We are calling on the government herself to ensure more quality assurance along the value chain, so that we can checkmate the system to ensure that we don't miss out on this process. And if there is anybody who has been alleged or suspected of being connected to this syndicate of corrupt network, those persons must be investigated and ensure that those investigation reports are transparent and credible and made available to the public, so that it can serve as a major deterrent to ending this major nightmare.
And how have Liberians reacted to these revelations? What are they saying?
The public outcry is very enormous. The citizens are concerned, because it's an everyday situation they are faced with. They go to health facilities. They don't have those essential drugs, the malaria commodities. So Liberians are concerned. The citizens have called on the government to ensure that there is accountability and transparency in the health supply chain system of this country.
And talking about solutions, you recently launched a campaign to improve the medicine supply chain. What does that involve? And would that effectively address, you know, this issue and avert, you know, diversion of medicine donated by aid agencies?
The campaign that got launched recently is a national campaign. So this campaign has been launched to create enough awareness on donor-donated medications and how citizens and stakeholders can contribute towards creating awareness and keeping their sites open, so that they can curtail or minimize the issue of corruption within the health supply chain system.
Thank you so much, John Alexander Nyan, for speaking to us on the podcast.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Liberian community activist John Alexander Nyan Jr. In February 2023, Kenya's President William Ruto made his biggest domestic security decision to deploy the military in the northern part of the country to quell a surge in bandit attacks. A year later, the outcome of the security intervention has been mixed. In recent months, 80 people have been killed and more than 2,000 people displaced in a series of bandit attacks despite the ongoing security operation. The raids are an age-old practice among pastoral communities, widely seen as a show of bravery by young people. The practice has since evolved into organized crime involving criminal networks that are profiteering from sale of cattle locally and as far as the Middle East. I've been speaking to Dr. Edgar Gedhua, a security expert based at Strathmore University in Nairobi. I began by asking him, what is cattle rustling and the bandits causing mayhem in northern Kenya?
Cattle rustling ideally is a term given to pastoralist communities that live in the northern Kenya, raiding each other and stealing livestock. Cattle, we're talking about goats, sheep, donkeys, camels, and it's born from traditional practice in these ethnic communities in the northern parts of Kenya. And this practice has been going on for very many years for various reasons, partly which include the need to get livestock so they could pay for their bride price, all right, when young men were about to go and get married. Part of the custom was that they're supposed to give out a number of livestock. So in order not to deplete their own stock of livestock, they would go and raid neighboring communities, and that is what they would end up giving as bride price or as dowry in African custom.
So how do these bandits who conduct this cattle rustling operate, and who's really their primary target?
Basically, the communities in northern Kenya that have been involved in this practice, we have the community called the Turkana. They are pastoralists, they are Nilots, and they are pastoralists. We have a community called some as the Samburus, some are Pokots, others are called Marakwets. Traditionally, the Pokots would even raid and go into Uganda and raid their counterparts called the Karamajongs from Uganda. And so that was that whole belt of cattle raiding. And primarily, it was traditional. And that's why for the longest time, it didn't seem to bother anyone because it was seasonal and it was only at specific times. In fact, all communities knew we are entering into the season of raiding. But over time, that has taken a different dynamic. And when it became commercialized now, that is when now it took a different turn. Raiding takes different forms. A long time ago, they would raid and just use traditional weapons of bows and arrows and spears. Nowadays, the banditry and the raiding is done with automatic weapons, with modern weapons. And that is where now the problem comes in, because a commercial element has now crept in. And it's not just about the traditional aspect of it, but there's a commercialization aspect to this banditry and raiding, and that is what raises and causes alarm.
I presume then there would be people who are facilitating this, because you brought out the element of commercialization. Who are the sponsors? Who are the backers?
The commercialization of banditry nowadays is pegged on the need for food, especially a lot of these animals that are stolen from these communities or cross-border are transported all the way to Nairobi. Chances are 30% of what you're eating is from this cattle raiding. So there's that commercialization aspect, meaning they are cartels. And I believe the security forces have time and again complained because some of the facilitators of these practices are politicians, big time businessmen. They are known, but they are sacred cows, you know, they are protected. And it is so pervasive and so dire such that even when the Parliament of Kenya and the Senate of Kenya bring out laws to criminalize banditry, these bills do not sail through the floor of the House.
The Kenyan President William Ruto said that he was going to deal decisively with cattle rustling by deploying a special contingent of the military, actually a battalion that will be permanently stationed in northern Kenya. So looking back, would you say this has been effective?
Yeah, to a large extent, it has. Incidences have reduced, not completely wiped out. The northern Kenya, the terrain and the topography and the geography of northern Kenya it's a very harsh, where we literally have these militias and these bandits. They've literally dug themselves into caves and such, network of caves, which the military take time in trying to find out where they are and to flush them out. Every once in a while, and currently already, some schools in that side are not operating because it's too unsafe to go to school. So the government has tried. Incidences have been reduced, not completely wiped out, but there is an ongoing operation that has been stationed there for quite some time.
And would you say that the criminals that were involved in this business could have changed tack in response to the government's military intervention?
Oh, yes, they change tack all the time. And that's a very good observation on your part. For example, whenever the military goes in, the first thing the government does, it gives out a blanket amnesty and it tells people, if you return your weapons, if you return your guns, there'll be an an amnesty for you. And unfortunately, what happens in some of these areas, nearly all families in those areas have automatic weapons. What they do is that they hand in the old weapons which they do not need, and then they reserve and go and hide and bury the new weapons that they have. So when the blanket amnesty ends and the government collects weapons, lo and behold, 2 months down the road, these people go and dig up their weapons and they resume. Because for them, that has become a lifeline. Remember, it's also a socioeconomic problem because of marginalization. The young men in those regions have not gone to school, do not know any other way of life, have been misused by politicians to enter into this fast track of getting quick money. So that is the only lifestyle they have.
What will be the most realistic way of dealing with this issue decisively once and for all?
Okay, that's a good question. Number one, it is not only a two-pronged approach, it is also an international approach, because we need the governments of Uganda, Kenya, and South Sudan and Ethiopia to sit down and come up with a common policy on how to handle this problem. Because this banditry crosses and traverses not only Kenya, it touches into Uganda, the Toposa of South Sudan, the Merile from Ethiopia, the Marakwets, the Pokots in Kenya. So we need an international approach as well as a local approach. The international approach will make sure that every country safeguards its borders, meaning put in place systems to prevent their ethnic and their nationals from crossing the borders to go and raid into Uganda, South Sudan, or Ethiopia. Have the military presence, disarm, and of course, deal decisively with the bandits who refuse to call to amnesty. And at the same time, bring in NGOs and social economic programs that are going to change the mindsets of these communities. Make them stop relying on pastoralism as a way of living. Try and show them their alternative, for example, farming, entrepreneurship, all these approaches to just try and make those communities try and stop relying on cattle rustling. And also reaching out to the youth, making sure they get proper education, proper exposure. It's a long-term approach. It is something that has taken 50, 60 years of their culture. We can't just get rid of it overnight. It is a gradual process, but we need to have the political will to change it. And then lastly, dealing with their leaders. Those leaders, political leaders, businessmen who fund these activities are known. So biting the bullet and, you know, having them brought to book and held to account, I think that that will be firing a warning shot, and that will send the right signal that cattle rustling is not the way to go.
All right. Thank you so much for those insights.
Thank you so much. Thank you for calling.
Edgar Gedhua, a security expert based at Strathmore University here in Nairobi. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. I'm Richard Kagoy. Nine women who were arrested in Zimbabwe for allegedly booing the First Lady have been released from prison and had their charges dropped. The women, who range from ages 19 to 48 years, had been at a charity event where Mrs. Auxilia Mnangagwa was handing out food and clothes, which they allegedly missed out on. Their alleged booing resulted in arrests, and they are being charged with unlawful abuse and insulting behavior towards the First Lady. But it was the First Lady and the Police Commissioner General who spoke out, condemning the police's action as an overreaction. There was an outcry from the Zimbabwean public, with some questioning if this is just the latest example of a rise in police brutality towards civilians. Here to tell us more is Tatenda Sigauke from Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, who represented the women in court. Tatenda, thank you so much for joining us on Focus on Africa podcast. So could you tell us how, you know, the women ended up being arrested?
So the nine women attended a function by the First Lady of Zimbabwe, where she was doing part of a charity work. During that event, they were alleged to have booed and interrupted her speech. And it is alleged that it was showing their disgruntlement for not receiving part of the things that she was also giving out to members of the community. So that is, by and large, the allegations that they are facing, or that they were facing at that time.
And was it a lawful arrest?
In terms of our law, there are a litany of laws that work against instances, say for against public order and things like that. So the one that they were charged with, less to disorderly conduct, So ordinarily, you wouldn't expect one to be arrested for either booing or for expressing themselves. But what happens is that usually there's a charge that is preferred in our criminal code. And for in this instance, they were charged with disorderly conduct. It is an offense in terms of the law that is there, but in terms of the circumstances, the facts, or the essential elements, that would be for the court. But essentially, the arrest would be lawful in the sense that they would be saying that you have violated a section of the criminal law code.
Mm-hmm. And there seems to be consensus because both the First Lady and the Police Commissioner General, they do agree that the officers who arrested the women seem to have overreacted. So why the reaction? And is this something that's common in Zimbabwe or is just an isolated incident?
Well, if we go by the nature of cases, I would say it's something that usually happens, that normally, like I said, there are various laws against public order and also some laws against the state, including laws relating to insulting the president and things like that. So ordinarily, the police would tend to arrest, particularly when it comes to civil and political rights issues. And obviously, in some instances, the cases from the cases that we receive, most of them, they end up being withdrawn. Some cases end up having verdicts of acquittal and people be found not guilty. And in some instances, the cases will just die a natural death in the sense that they will not be prosecuted any further. So usually it happens that people are arrested for the infractions of these laws by the police. And in the management of the cases, as we go up in terms of going to court and the like, you find that most of them will not be concluded, some of them will not be prosecuted, others will be withdrawn and things like that.
And under what circumstances were they freed?
I believe it was after they appeared before the court, and I think that there was a bit of a public outcry over the matter. In the following the discussions that you've indicated that there was sentiments that the police had overreacted, they were then brought before the court where they were advised that the charges were being withdrawn. And the fact that they were now being withdrawn after they had pleaded to the offense meant that they would be found not guilty and they were acquitted of the charges.
And just looking at the criticism that the police didn't come as though they were heavy-handed, is that something that's common in Zimbabwe these days?
From the cases that we receive at Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, you find that it's something that is common, particularly in cases of civil and political rights, where the usually the reaction is to charge people in those instances. But then maybe in through further management and the like, the authorities maybe realize that probably it's not proper or it's not something that should we take further. So it happens sometimes from the cases that we receive that some charges will be thrown, others will also be thrown out by the courts and the like. But the processes of particularly in the political spheres or in the exercise of political rights, you find that some people end up facing criminal charges relating to public order or relating to crimes against the state.
And so what's the current situation in Zimbabwe regarding freedom of speech or even freedom of protest?
I would say that, as I highlighted, that we have various laws that are in our criminal law code, particularly when you talk of your crimes against the state, that they have an offense of undermining the authority or insulting the president. We also have crimes against public order for disorderly conduct. In this instance, the one being that was used to charge these ladies. So you would find that when it comes to the exercise of civil and political rights, these, from the cases that we receive, these tend to be the offenses that are then used. But maybe in general, when you look at it, and also the advent of the digital platforms, you'll find that people do express themselves. However, when it comes to the civil and political or the exercise of civil and political rights, you find that most of our clients are political activists who are then charged for saying certain things against the government in relation to the offenses that I have said. The ordinary people, usually, you would find they are also part of our clients. They usually face the charges of undermining the authority
authority and things like that from the cases that we receive. So generally, I would say that in the exercise of civil and political rights, you would then find this limitation, particularly when it comes to political activism.
So you've raised very important points there in terms of political and civil rights. What changes are you advocating for as an organization that seems to be dealing with lots of these complaints?
Generally, we advocate for the upholding of human rights and also the expansion of these freedoms. In particular, when you look at our laws that seem to be curtailing those freedoms, and the fact that you may face charges of having maybe raised a complaint and things like that. So it is the interpretation of these laws that is subject probably to misinterpretation and the use in maybe curtailing some rights, particularly in the civil and political spaces. So what we would advocate for is generally that that culture of promoting these freedoms and these rights be institutionalized, particularly within the police, so that they also appreciate that it is indeed normal sometimes to raise a complaint, and that it is within the rights that people have, so that they don't necessarily use these laws against the public, particularly when the sentiment is against government.
All right, Tatenda, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Tatenda Sigauke, talking to me from Harare. Thanks for listening. This episode of Focus on Africa was produced by Yvette Togira Maria, Daniel Dadzi, Bella Hassan, and Nyasha Michelle in London. Paul Bachubinga was in charge, and Chris Kuzaris was our technical producer. The editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Modengi. I'm Richard Kagoe.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.